Welcome to the Life Sciences Revolution Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Wise, and today we're going to be taking a look at the nature-inspired world of biomimicry. We're going to be speaking with Dr. Nosher Pasika, professor of chemical and biomolecular engineering at Tulane University. Nosher specializes in polymer surface engineering, where he focuses his research on creating bio-inspired products, devices and materials that are based off of the micro and nano structures found in the natural world. He's been working on creating high-strength adhesives based on gecko pads, artificial articular cartilage for knee replacements, and many other biomimetic concepts. We'll be hearing about all of these, along with insights from his time as a PhD student at Johns Hopkins, a postgrad at UC Santa Barbara, and most uniquely, what it was like moving from Mauritius to the States to pursue his goals of becoming a chemical engineer researcher. So now, without further ado, here's my conversation with Dr. Nosher Pasika. So, Nosher, you're a chemical engineer by training, and your research falls into the same field. But what I think really sets your style apart and aside is this concept of biomimicry and bio-inspired materials that, you know, that underpins your research. And so I guess that's the idea where you as a scientist, you know, take a microscope, maybe metaphorically and literally, to the natural world to find inspiration for design and development of products. Although this may be present in other sects of chemical engineering, I feel like this is just a little bit more upfront with your research interests. So can you give us an introduction to biomimicry, the way you approach research, and how this style applies to the realm of life sciences and medicine?
Yeah, so this field of biomimicry, I never really thought about it until I did my postdoc. At that time, we were working on trying to come up with a reusable adhesive, and we were inspired by the gecko lizard at the time to kind of make up a dry material that would stick reversibly to surfaces, and that was my first experience with biomimicry. I think just the concept of biomimicry is just, to me, it's in a way, nature has already had so many thousands of years to evolve organisms to come up with optimal sort of structures. So animals encounter obstacles every day, and they've come up with these really extraordinary structures to overcome whatever problems they encounter. So the idea is that why kind of reinvent the wheel when we can just sort of use nature as inspiration? And we're not trying to completely replicate nature. The idea is just to be inspired by nature. So in many cases, the structure that nature has produced is just too complicated, or we don't fully understand it. But as engineers, we can sort of identify at least a few of the features and then develop hypotheses for why we think these features are necessary. And then we can test it out and make an artificial version. So yeah, so that I thought that was really powerful for me, as far as using nature as inspiration. And although I've worked on many projects, I think those are the bio-inspired projects are the one that caught more of my attention, and I kind of devoted more effort there. And then as I became an independent researcher, that's the direction my lab took, as far as when we want to solve a problem, we think about where does this similar problem exist in nature, and how do plants and organisms sort of tackle those problems.
Awesome. So it sounds like it's, you know, really crossed the whole, you know, animal kingdom per se. And I really enjoy this concept, you know, because it feels quite tangible, you know, like reverse engineering something in the natural world, maybe with some degree of similarity, as you said, not the exact same, but yeah, not reinventing the wheel and just seeing that it works and then going ahead and turning it into discovery, design, and iteration problem.
But yeah, and then I think that's where, as chemical engineers or as other engineers as well, that's where even if we cannot completely replicate what nature has done, we can come up with alternatives but still be inspired by the structure. As an example, the going back to the gecko structure, the structures are extremely tiny, to the point where just thinking about our current micro nanofabrication techniques, it's just something that we cannot commercially fabricate or mass produce a large segment or a large sample of a gecko type of tape. But as engineers, we can think about, okay, maybe we'll sacrifice some of the adhesion capabilities that geckos have, but maybe make some structure that's a little bit larger, less complicated, but still follow the same principles.
It sounds like you're going through the same engineering black box idea, that you're kind of looking at the end point and you say, okay, as an engineer, you have A, you need to get to B, or B, you want to get back to A, and something happens in the middle. What pieces can you take from the natural world and put them there and get your desired outcome, whether it's half of it, or half of the gecko structure, I'm just using arbitrary percentages there, or the whole thing, or 10%. And we'll come back to the gecko. Yep. A lot of it later. But I was curious, how do you approach this idea of biomimicry and studying the natural systems and the ones that you've chosen to focus your research on? I mean, how do you identify these types of systems for potential applications? And I don't know if it's like a mental and scientific pipeline or if it's what you did in your research as a postdoc you mentioned. Can you go into that a little bit?
Sure. So honestly, a lot of it is watching nature shows on TV and just kind of seeing what cool things plants and animals do. I think just inherently, because I'm interested in it, it kind of just sticks in my mind.
Mm-hmm. So I'm a big fan of David Attenborough and
there we go. Yeah.
love it.
But yeah, so that's sort of, I kind of have an inherent library in the back of my mind of things that animals and plants do that's unique. And in many cases, I can't really think of an application that's relevant right now. But then if we're trying to develop a proposal around some idea, I'll try to kind of think back about, was there something that I could use from nature? And so as an example, being inspired by the circulation system of the human body to come up with a sort of a self-healing surface. So if you imagine you're sending a spacecraft and you'll be traveling years and years, and maybe it's an unmanned spacecraft. What if you encounter a meteoroid that cracks the hull? Can we come up with a living surface, something that is continuously circulating material that can repair the hull of the spacecraft on its own? So this is sort of, again, just inspired by thinking of the human circulation system. You get a cut, blood accumulates on the cracks or on where you have your cut. So rather than worrying about the complexity of through biology, but just being inspired by the circulation system, coming up with a hull that has its own circulation system of the whatever cells or cell mimic that would accumulate at the crack site and repair itself.
It's a really interesting application. I hadn't considered anything maybe extraterrestrial in the sense of going out of our stratosphere there. Sounds like you have maybe like a little mental Rolodex of interesting animals or plants or ideas that you can kind of pull from. And I kind of have this idea, maybe if you like walking around as like a scientist, looking at different plants and animals, trying to elucidate how these organisms, are doing what they're doing. It seems very pure science to me. But anyways, before we get into your different projects, the gecko and such, as you mentioned, aside from those, I mean, you've given us some examples. Do you have any other life sciences examples that maybe we could tie in?
The most relevant one is we're trying to make an artificial cartilage material, something that is very slippery, that's biocompatible, that will essentially serve as a meniscus replacement or even as a cartilage surface replacement. So this was, again, just sort of thinking about people who have a torn meniscus or who have an early onset of arthritis. Can we come up with a solution for them as opposed to taking gel shots or having a total knee replacement? Can we come up with a polymer that we can slide in between the joints that would serve the purpose of your natural cartilage? And again, being bio-inspired, we think about, okay, well, if we want to do that, we know that natural cartilage is already a really good biomaterial that serves the purpose. Let's figure out how cartilage works or the meniscus works, and then use polymers to make a mimic and then test it out and see whether it actually works the way we hope it works.
Well, let's dig into this this knee cartilage project a little bit more. So can you give us a little bit of background maybe about the knee? You mentioned the meniscus, you mentioned the cartilage. What exactly were you using as the materials here? I know there's this core concept, the very aptly named load-induced hydrodynamic lubrication. Can you talk a little bit about that and how that works in with this project?
Sure. So the way we think about cartilage or the meniscus the physics behind how it works is a combination of both a surface property as well as the fluid in your joints. So in your joints, you have the synovial fluid that has proteins and various other molecules that help with the lubrication. But it's not just the lubricant, synovial fluid as a lubricant. It's also, you have to also worry about the cartilage material and what purpose it's playing. So what we've discovered is that the natural cartilage in your joints, you can think of it as a spongy material where when you apply a load on the cartilage, it gushes out synovial fluid unidirectionally, so just upwards. So as opposed to a sponge where you squeeze the sponge and liquid comes out everywhere, in the case of cartilage, it's sort of directional. And so the fluid gushes out only upwards. And in doing so, it creates a thin film of synovial fluid that continuously separates the cartilage materials on your bones. So as opposed to having cartilage rubbing against cartilage, you now have cartilage shearing against a thin synovial fluid layer. And that helps prevent the wear of your cartilage. And so that's sort of the physics that we wanted to sort of replicate or mimic in our polymers. And so we thought about what's a good polymer to choose. So we needed something that's compliant and something that's going to be a little bit somewhat soft so that we can, once we make these tiny little pores in there, we can extrude fluid. And so we ended up looking at a family of silicone-based polymers that are known to be biocompatible.
So really quick, all these polymers, they're completely synthetic. There's nothing biological with these. It's exclusively a device, right?
Yeah, it's a polymer that you can just buy commercially, no bio component to it.
Mm. Interesting. So you're taking essentially a polymer, you know, a biocompatible type of plastic per se, and then doing something to it. I'm not sure if you can talk about what's actually being done to that.
Sure.
But Yeah.
So we just drill tiny little holes in the polymer, or we find other ways of making tiny little wells that can store the synovial fluid. And then the idea is exactly how cartilage works. If we have these little reservoirs that are storing the fluid, when a person makes a step, they apply a pressure onto this material, onto this artificial cartilage, and it extrudes fluid in the right direction, provide that lubricating film. So yeah, it's essentially just making a unidirectional sponge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so you said at the beginning, these surfaces are very slippery, very low friction. How low friction can you get with this? I mean, I don't know what the numbers are for cartilage versus the proposed device, but as a percentage or multiple, how close are you?
Yeah, so that's one issue that we need to think about as we move forward. Cartilage itself has friction values that are extremely low. So it's the friction is sort of characterized by this property of two materials sharing against each other, which is the coefficient of friction. So it's the coefficient of friction is essentially the friction force divided by the load that you're applying. Mm-hmm. So the harder you push on a surface and you try rubbing, the higher is going to be the friction. And how much that friction increases by is proportional to this coefficient of friction value. So just to give you an idea, if you take something like steel, on steel, and you try rubbing two surfaces of steel against each other, that coefficient of friction is about 0.4 to 0.5. So meaning that push with 100 grams, you slide with 50 grams.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So that gives you the coefficient of friction. In the case of the natural cartilage, the coefficient of friction is something on the order of like 0.001. Or even some people have reported 0.0001. It's essentially what's referred to as super lubricity. So essentially, if you're applying 100 grams on the surface of the cartilage and you try to slide it, the friction force is something like 0.1 grams. And so extremely, extremely slippery. We are nowhere close to that yet. And that's one question where we need to figure out whether if you have this artificial meniscus in your body, how much lubricity is important. Of course, you want it to be as slippery as possible, but is there a point where you don't really notice that it's in your joints, that it's just sliding to the point where you just cannot detect that it's sliding with a coefficient of friction of 0.1 versus 0.01 or 0.0001? So that's going to be something that we'll have to kind of think about as we get into sort of human trials to see how slippery we need to be. Right now, we can go the best coefficient of friction we have is on the order of 0.1 or 0.09 around that scale. So still orders of magnitude higher than natural cartilage. But the caveat there is, I guess I should mention that all the experiments we've been doing have been with just water. Mm-hmm. So water is itself a very poor lubricant. Mm-hmm. So I think once we get into animal testing models and we start using synovial fluid, that should aid in bringing down the coefficient of friction even further. Mm-hmm. Yeah, at this point, we're not anywhere close to natural cartilage. It's just nature has had a much longer time than I have to come up with a better solution to make it more slippery.
Yeah, fair enough. That's where the design and iteration comes in a bit. But hey, it's still a lot better than steel on steel, as you mentioned at the beginning there.
For sure.
Interesting. So it's just you take it and put it in the knee, I guess, on top of, you know, the tibia, along those lines. And then I guess, you know, you mentioned getting the friction down to a point at which it doesn't potentially become noticeable, but I imagine it will make a difference maybe with your longevity and how efficient it works with the device there. But irrespective of that, where along in the developmental pipeline are you and what regulatory steps are you looking at going forward? Is there anything like this on the market?
There is a version of it that it's essentially a polymer that's inserted in between the joints that provides this sort of shock absorbance. But the lubricity part, how low of a friction it achieves and how long would it last in the body, that's still sort of unknown. And so we're hoping that our novelty will be this texturing of the polymer to provide that additional lubricity. And hopefully that will allow this structure to be, like the durability of the structure in the body to be prolonged even further. Mm-hmm. As far as where we are right now, we're sort of taking two directions. Part of it is still on the technical side, improving the structure, trying to come up with alternatives to the polymers we're using currently to see whether we can come up with tougher polymers, meaning polymers that would degrade less compared to what we have right now, polymers that do not trigger any inflammation response over time. So that's more on the technical side. And then, of course, trying to lower the friction as much as possible. And then thinking about ways of securing the artificial meniscus in place in the joints, whether we can just rely on molding the polymer in a shape that would be a perfect fit in your joints and would on its own just remain in place, or whether we need to actually attach it to your tendons or to the bones. So that's something else we're kind of thinking about. And then on the more on the business aspect of it, we eventually hope to commercialize this sort of technology. On that side, we're looking at essentially talking to surgeons to think about what problems they foresee using this kind of a device, and then just trying to figure out the right people we need to be talking to see what's the when we're ready to commercialize this product, what path we need to take to get the right approvals and the who's going to give us the yes or the no. Mm-hmm. That's really where we're at right now.
That's a very good top down. I appreciate there, and it's a good segue because you mentioned, you know, sticking it in, getting it to stay in the knee, and so that's a good segue, I think, for the next section, talking about the opposite. So if we're talking about low friction, now let's talk high friction. Maybe some adhesives. You've got a gecko inspired adhesive project. So I want to talk lizards now, and so for anyone listening, I'm sure if you've seen a gecko, I want you just to go ahead and you can imagine it where you saw it. And I'm going to go ahead and take a guess and say that if you're imagining a gecko right now, it's probably on a wall, climbing up a wall, running across the ceiling or something along those lines. And no, sure, I'll go out on a limb and say maybe the first time you saw a gecko was also something like that. And then going back to what we were saying about biomimicry, seeing something in the natural world and then trying to replicate it in the lab. Can you walk us through this concept and what you've been developing as far as next generation adhesive goes with this concept and what makes geckos so unique?
Sure. So yeah, the geckos, they've evolved their toe pads to have this sort of reversible adhesive property. It's really sort of clever what nature has done as far as using a mechanism that I would honestly have never thought about something like that on my own. It's essentially just touching two materials to each other and relying on extremely weak forces. These are called van der Waals forces. These are forces that are electrostatic in nature. They are always present in between two surfaces, but we are always taught in classes or that they are extremely weak forces that just are just present everywhere. But no one really thought about using them in any useful way. But nature and the geckos have kind of evolved their structures on their toes to be able to make really intimate contact. So their toes are made up of these structures that break up into even tinier structures. So you can think of it like a tree trunk that breaks up into branches and then breaks up further into tinier branches. And then at the end of those branches are little leaves. And these leaves are really thin and flexible. And so geckos have something, a similar structure. They have many of these trees making a forest. And then at the end of the branches are these leaves that are very flexible. They're made up of beta keratin. So it's the same material as your hair or as your nails, a relatively tough material. So it's really hard. But when you make that hard material really thin, it becomes really flexible. And so the effect of what we call the modulus of the material is becomes really low. So it can conform to surfaces very easily. If this material is touching a rough surface, it can easily bend and kind of enter the crevices of rough surfaces. And in doing so, it makes intimate contact with surfaces. And when I say intimate contact, it's really to the point where atoms are touching atoms on the opposing surface. And when you're in that scenario, the van der Waals forces can become very strong. And so geckos have managed to kind of allow for this intimate contact over large areas. And that's how they're able to kind of stick to almost any surface. So very clever way of doing it. And for this particular project, it was only until people were able to look at the structures with an electron microscope, were they able to kind of see the microstructures and the nanoscale structures on the geckos. And then they appreciated that, okay, it's not a vacuum suction mechanism. It's not the gecko releasing some gooey material. It's not capillary forces. But indeed, it was a van der Waals forces, something that no one would really expect. That was the dominant mechanism by which they stuck to surfaces.
Interesting. So no actual adhesives there. It's purely mechanical. And so it's intimate contact, like surface area related, or?
Yeah, it's the separation distance between the two surfaces. So you want those two surfaces that you want to stick to each other to be extremely close to each other. And when I say extremely close, the number that people use is something like 0.2 nanometers is what we consider contact between sort of atoms and atoms.
So very small, very small.
Very small, very, very small. And of course, the contact area, the adhesion force will be proportional to the contact area. So the more contact you make, the stronger that force is going to be.
Mm. So what kind of multiple on adhesion are you getting versus, you know, say a piece of paper, stick it on the wall with versus a gecko structure? What kind of order of magnitude increase are we talking about here?
Adhesive tapes, people have engineered these tacky materials, and 3M, for example, comes to mind, and they're kind of the leaders in sort of adhesives. They've come up with things like super glue and, other more chemical based approaches where you're making covalent bonds with opposing surfaces. And so as far as, van der Waals forces, which is a physical force, compared to covalent interaction, the synthetic glues and those will always win out. So these are always stronger. But what makes the gecko structure attractive is that it's reversible. So you can design the gecko structure or an artificial version of the gecko structure so that depending on how you actuate it, you can either activate the adhesion so it can stick, and then you can actuate the adhesive in a different manner for it to come off easily. And it's reusable. So I think that's where the unique aspect of a gecko-like tape comes in, as opposed to your conventional tapes that over time, their adhesion might drop just because they get contaminated with dust or anything else. Geckos, they can essentially stick over and over again. And you see geckos climbing surfaces. They climb dusty surfaces. They climb clean surfaces. They go on glass. They go on rocks. They don't care. These pads remain sticky for long periods of time, meaning 30 days before they shed and come up with, and a new pad is exposed. But during that 30-day duration, they can use their pads multiple times.
Hmm. I can definitely see how this could have some applications, maybe in the surgical realm, with devices, you know, wound dressings and such, which I'll give a question to you about that in a second. But first, what is it like making this type of structure versus what we previously spoke about with the low friction, and how do you test this in the lab?
Yeah, so the technology that we use, at least the fabrication techniques we use is very similar to what we use to develop the artificial cartilage material. So it's called photolithography. So it's essentially relying on a polymer that's sensitive to light, where if light hits it, it either gets stiffer or light breaks down the molecules of the polymer and makes it easy to come off. And so briefly, you essentially take a surface, you coat it with this light sensitive polymer, and then you cover that up with a mask. The mask will have the features that you're interested in. So maybe it can be an array of little holes or an array of little rectangular structures or whatever you're interested in. And then you shine light through that mask, and wherever light is able to go through, it encounters the polymer and then will change its chemistry to make it either harder or softer. And then you can go for a developing step to remove the softer material, and you're left behind with the sort of a replica or three-dimensional structure that you got from the mask design.
Kind of like a negative.
Yeah. So we use that same process to create little pads on a surface. So I should mention that it's a combination of using photolithography as well as molding. So we'll create what we call a master mold, which is the developed by using photolithography. But then we'll create other molds that are based on softer polymers, something like silicone polymers, where if they're more flexible, we can peel them out and then we can create multiple replicas of our desired structure. Mm-hmm. So in the case of the geckos, we have some more intricate designs that function better, but we are also, again, chasing the commercial aspect of it. We need to kind of maybe sacrifice some of the adhesion capability in order to make the fabrication process something that can be mass produced. Mm-hmm. So we're simplifying our design. We know we're going to be sacrificing some of the adhesion forces that we have, but what we gain out of it is going to be something that where we can use a roll-to-roll process to make a lot of this gecko-like tape material. Mm. We're using polyurethanes and silicones as our sort of polymers, and it's essentially little pads that are coming out that are flexible and that can also make intimate contact with opposing surfaces.
So kind of weighing the structure engineering side and the commercial engineering side. But when it comes to, like, literally, you know, testing this in the lab, I'm kind of imagining you with, you know, gecko pads on your hands or, you know, sticking it to the wall and seeing if you can climb it up, you know, maybe Spy Kids style or movie style. How strong can you get these? I mean, what would it take to hold up a human?
Yeah, so the latest version of the gecko structure we have, we do the testing, of course, in the lab where we have a well-controlled surface area that we make in contact with, that we make contact with the with our gecko type tape, and then we'll shear it under ideal conditions and measure the forces that we get.
Right.
The testing we do is on a very tiny area, so sort of on millimeter by millimeter length scale testing in the lab. But if we were to scale that up to something like if we were to reproduce the structure on a sheet of paper, something that's maybe 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper, and we had all of that covered with gecko structures, and we could make all of that area stick to a surface, then it should easily hold on the order of 120 to 150 pounds. So you can imagine holding a person's weight with one sheet of paper. So the ultimate goal here, or at least my goal, is to be able to take a sheet of paper with the gecko structures, cut it in four, two for your legs and two for your hands, and see if you can climb a surface using that kind of structure.
There we go. And then the Spy Kids movie type structures are a reality there.
There you go.
Awesome. Yeah. And maybe I would need a few more sheets of paper. I've been having a few too many, nice dinners recently. But aside from the Spy Kids style, what do you see as, you know, real world application in the medical realm? Any thoughts on medicine or life sciences there?
So the nice thing is that these structures stick through what's called these van der Waals forces. And so van der Waals forces, they are still present under liquids. The forces do drop because of the liquid being present, but it's still present, which is nice because, for example, if you want to come up with a different way of sticking maybe medical devices within the body or probes on your skin, as opposed to using an adhesive tape that potentially can be sensitive to skin or can cause pain when removing the tape. Something like a gecko structure could potentially be useful there, where simply by the way you actuate it, you can easily release it without causing any damage to the skin or causing pain to the skin. So I think that's one place where we think we can use these gecko-like structures to stick to skin through these weak van der Waals forces. I say weak van der Waals forces as meaning that we can take them off easily without damaging them, but they're strong enough to be able to hold probes onto or medical devices. If you have a little heart monitor or something, you can use that to stick on skin.
Interesting. Maybe a little diabetes, blood sugar monitor, right. something along those lines. Interesting. Nice. So now we have the gecko. So the high friction and the cartilage, low friction. Any other, if you zoom out, any other future advancements and interesting things going on in the field of biomimicry with their potential impact in medicine and life sciences?
Those are the ones I'm working on currently. There's some other projects that are not sort of life science related. But to me, I think the human cell is itself like a little reactor that I think we still have a long ways to go to truly appreciate what cells do in our body. And being able to kind of replicate those functions, so thinking about the T cells in your body and how they can go around and identify impurities or things that should not be in your body and then attack them. And we come up with our own version of T-cell robots that are bio-inspired by these T cells that could be circulating in your body and doing that function. So that's something that is very futuristic, but I don't think is unrealistic as far as coming up with tiny little robots that circulate within your body and target cancer cells, for example, or if there are bacteria floating around, identify those and then kill them off. So hopefully that gives you some sort of inspiration for some future technologies that could be there. I don't think we're close yet, but I think we're moving in that direction.
That would be kind of cool. And this is, after all, the life sciences revolution. So we got to be looking forward to the future as, maybe some self-assembly nanoscale robots that are functioning like T cells. We'll have to have you back on for another full-fledged discussion of that in a couple of years when those are hopefully being rolled out in the clinic. Great. Let's come back to you and your career and then some advice for our listeners. And so I'll try to do some justice for your background and CV. So you're from Mauritius originally, which for the less geographically inclined is an island off the East Coast, Madagascar, in Africa, and then moved to the States. I went to Carnegie Mellon for undergrad in chemical engineering and French, Johns Hopkins PhD in chemical engineering, UC Santa Barbara for postgraduate, and now Tulane University, professor of chemical engineering. And then, as we said, taking an interesting path with the chemical engineering side, with the biomimicry. So can you tell us what it was like, switching hemispheres in your late teen years and how you've seen your career progress along this way? And any advice you might have for someone listening who's considering a career in sciences and chemical engineering who might be in a similar position or similar situation?
Yeah, I can't say that I knew earlier on that chemical engineering was what I wanted to do. I was always curious about things. I always had questions about how things worked. And as a kid, any new toy I had eventually would get dismantled and reassembled in an improper way, or I would integrate different things together to come up with something what I thought was cooler. So that curiosity was always there. I just didn't know where I wanted to apply it. When I guess my first sort of experience with chemical engineering was at Carnegie Mellon, and I had a really good professor who taught Introduction to Chemical Engineering. And I think that was kind of the hook that got me interested in seeing what chemical engineers do. All I knew about chemical engineering in the past was that it had to do with the petroleum industry and you would get a job in a power plant or in distilling oil. But I quickly realized that that's part of what we do as chemical engineers, but we can apply that the training we got as chemical engineers to many other fields and just coming up with materials, new materials. One is one area. The energy sector is the other area, coming up with alternatives to oils or petroleum. And then the life sciences is also something that chemical engineers get involved in. And so even at Tulane, the faculty, we have the department kind of cover all of those different fields. We have people doing life science work. We have people doing work more in the environment related topics. We have people doing more materials work like myself. And then we have people doing work in energy related areas, developing new catalyst materials. So yeah, chemical engineering itself is just, I like to think of us as universal engineers. We can really apply what we've been taught to tackle any problem from any other field. I think it's the way we're trained to approach a problem and then to identify, as far as engineering goes, what are the needs, and then trying to optimize the process to come up with a solution. So yeah, again, that's chemical engineering is something that really appealed to me when I was at Carnegie Mellon. And then I was fortunate enough to get some research experience as an undergrad. So that would be, I guess, my advice for anyone who is kind of unsure or is curious about whether chemical engineering or engineering in general or the life sciences is something that's of interest to them. Just go do it. Just go get a research experience, get an internship experience, and just see what it's like to work with other people in the community. And that will tell you that, yes, this is for me or this is not for me. So really just getting that experience earlier on, not getting that information from textbooks, because that's different, but really just the everyday, you go to the lab and you're cleaning beakers and you're having brainstorming sessions with your teammates, whether that's what appeals to you or not. So yeah, then chemical engineering as an undergrad, and then I decided to go to grad school because I was still very curious and I didn't feel like getting a job at that point would be satisfying enough. I knew I wanted to go into research, and I was told that having a PhD really helps you get those R&D jobs. And so I went to get a PhD. And then during my PhD, I learned that I didn't really want to get a job in industry. I really wanted to research things that I thought were interesting, not what industry would dictate me to research. And so that's where academia came up and as an option, and no regrets. It's a great field where I can essentially decide what interests me. And as long as I'm able to get the funding to do the research, that's all it takes.
That's awesome. Well, I'm glad that you're enjoying the route you've taken. As you said, optimize the process to find the solution. I think hopefully you've done that. And it sounds like you have with your career right there. And excellent advice to everyone on why you should be a chemical engineer. All right. Well, on that note, I'll just say one thing, and I apologize in advance because I'm going to undoubtedly butcher it, but no sheer. C'était un plaisir pour nous de t'aimer leur podcast la sortie. Merci plutôt d'attendre. I butchered it. No sure. Thank you for coming on the podcast. That's my attempt at
very close.
For you. Yeah. It was close. I'll take it. If I get I think a C is going to be a passing grade on that linguistics side right there.
Thank you for having me on. This was, it's always a pleasure to kind of talk about the more recent developments in the lab and to encourage the younger folks out there to consider engineering or the sciences as a career path.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Life Science Revolution podcast with Dr. Noshir Pasika. If you did, then please leave us a review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Make sure to check out some of our other episodes and stay tuned for the next one. And with that, here's Jenk Setups in Motion to close us out.